Greetings once again, America. My name's Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the World View. That's right, it's the Weekly World View. And I am your humble host, Doug McBurney. Glad to have you back on the show. Well, we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And as we launch here into another week, well, launch. I shouldn't say launch. I was going to say launch at full throttle, but in fact, I think we're just going to ease it out of the driveway this week as full throttle is... Well, it's a bit more than I can take these days. And maybe you'll understand as I start with our first story. We go to Roseburg, Oregon. And this is from Breitbart's website, taken down from the Associated Press. Roseburg, Oregon, a diabetic man from Oregon who awoke to find that his dog had eaten three of his toes, says he's recovering and hopes to leave the hospital soon. James Little told the Associated Press last Friday that he's doing fine and resting, but he declined to say much of anything else. He called 911 last Tuesday to say that his dog had eaten part of his right foot while he was sleeping, including three of his toes. The hospital says Little is in fair condition and, was expected to leave the hospital hopefully by the end of this past week. Little had no feeling in his feet because of diabetes. Now, a Roseburg veterinarian says the dog may have been trying to rid his owner of dead tissue, which is not uncommon. So, I mean, you've heard of those dogs who sniff out cancer and the like. So the dog saw the, you know. Anyway, I just wanted to open up with that story for anyone who thought they had a lousy week. I mean, if you can at least still count your toes, then things aren't going all that badly for you. I tell you what. Okay. So let's get that out of the way. Now, what do I want to go with here? I just don't know where to start. I tell you what. I'm losing interest in the news more and more as the days go by, and as the news cycles are dominated more and more by the fantastically stupid. I find it hard to gut it out every week and do this show. I know I shouldn't complain. I know. What have I got to complain about? But I'm complaining. All right. Do I want to start out with the chess? No, I better wait on the chess.
Is that with Charlie Sheen?
No, this is going to be a Sheen-free zone. This will be the only place in the media for this. Well, who knows? I mean, Sheen could be dead by the end of the week. I shouldn't say. Of course, then he'd be in the news even more. Now, look, I've already dedicated 25 seconds to him, and I had promised I wouldn't do that. Let's move on to serious news from the Science File. We've got some interesting news. This is from Health Day News, pulled it down off a Yahoo News service. More than one-third of Americans routinely sleep fewer than 7 hours a night. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention over there in Washington, D.C., published two sleep studies earlier this week in its Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Now, you see, I'm complaining because I'm doing the podcast here. Can you imagine if you had to put in 8 hours a day working on the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report every week? Do we have to go into this every week? Well, anyways, the report is out. Americans are not sleeping enough. And they say changing lifestyle habits. This doesn't include Charlie Sheen. Well, maybe it does. Anyway, I apologize for that. It's just such an easy target, you know? But Charlie Sheen is what I would have been had I tasted any success early in my career. I would be exactly what Charlie Sheen is now. I'm glad I was an utter failure for most of my young adult life. Let's see, a financial success, that is, because I believe that's all that he's accomplished, is some level of fleeting financial success. But let's move on. Back to the sleep. So folks aren't sleeping enough. The report says changing lifestyle habits, including longer work days and late nights on the computer, have pared away much-needed sleep time from Americans. The National Sleep Foundation recommends that adults sleep from 7 to 9 hours a night to maintain good health.
You're doing well.
I'm doing really well. Now, I have organized my lifestyle in a fashion to where I get usually at least 8 hours of sleep. Am I correct? Mm-hmm. At least 8 hours. And that's why I've retained my girlish figure. And my
what's that mean?
And my the healthy glow to my skin. Oh, okay. It's just getting enough sleep. But, you know, this is a serious issue. People in my own circle of influence and friends who I worry about because they don't sleep enough and they don't seem to think they need to sleep enough. But it's best for all you youngsters out there. Try to organize your life in a fashion to where you get enough sleep, because if you don't get enough sleep, I mean, you might wake up with three fewer toes. I mean, who knows what could happen to you? It's a scary world out there. We live in a broken, fallen universe. And you need to recharge your batteries, okay? So that's my health advice for the week. All right, now let's go into the culture file. From Morgantown, West Virginia, Frank Buckles enlisted in World War I at 16 years of age after lying about his age. He died this past Sunday on his farm in Charlestown, West Virginia. Nearly a month after his 110th birthday, he was the last living World War I veteran in the United States. The last American doughboy has passed from the scene. When asked in February 2008 how it felt to be the last survivor of World War I, Buckley said simply, "I realized that somebody had to be, and it was me." Well, that's pretty profound. Somebody had to be. Anyway, I suppose that's a good enough attitude to have when you're 108 years old. Only two other World War veterans are known to be alive on the planet today: Florence Green in Britain and Claude Choulet in Australia. They're the final two. Green turned 110 on February 19th, and Choulet turns 110 this month. Okay, so a generation passing, literally right before our eyes. Buckles, it is said, was not ill at the time of his death. He was not even ill. I didn't even know he was sick. But he was 110 years old. I guess there's not much more you can say about that. As far as we know, he had all 10 of his toes. Yes. All right. Now, let's... Oh, no, I've forgotten to turn off the program that should never be turned on. So let's turn that off. Okay. Sorry about that.
Is it Charlie Sheen up
there? that was my RSS feed from the new XM satellite Charlie Sheen channel. It came in a... All right, I'm so sorry. How can you avoid it?
I don't know.
Anyway, let's move on to more serious news, okay, from Harvard. Is this from Harvard? Yes, let's see here. Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust... excuse me, I apologize. I need to pronounce that correctly. Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust and Navy Secretary Ray Mavis signed an agreement last Friday that will reestablish Naval ROTC, reestablish their formal presence on the campus at Harvard for the first time since the Vietnam War. Yeah, so ROTC, that's a Reserve Officers Training Corps, I think. I don't know, it's an Army thing. I never kept up with all that kind of stuff. But apparently, ROTC was kicked off the Harvard campus back in the heady days of the Vietnam War protests. And now, well, according to this article from MSNBC, ROTC first executed amid anti-war sentiment, okay? But I guess now the folks at Harvard are okay with two wars as long as a liberal black guy is in charge. Then they're okay with all that. MSNBC reminds us that Harvard lately kept ROTC off campus because of, what, the two wars? No, the policy that prevented homosexuals from serving openly. I've been bothered lately. What does it mean to serve openly as a homosexual? I mean, let's say you're a black guy and you want to serve openly. Well, that just means you walk around and you just got your black skin on and you're just a regular fella. But now, if you're queer, what does it mean to serve openly? Does that mean that you remind everyone perpetually that you're homosexual? Does that mean you try to kiss or date? It's just bothering me. This whole thing bothers me. And ROTC, going back to Harvard. Anyway, the The article concludes, Harvard is the first elite school to agree to rescind its ban on ROTC since December. And Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust said the, quote, renewed relationship affirms the armed forces' vital role in securing our freedoms. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Faust. I'm not sure we needed Harvard to affirm the armed forces' vital role in securing our freedoms. But we do appreciate the thought from there in the ivory towers of Harvard University. Now, how many hardcore Army lieutenant colonels do you think are going to come out of Harvard this young? How many career men for the Army? Buck up, lads. Chin up. All right. Anyway. So they let the fags run wild in the military, and now it's okay with Harvard. Probably have to have some openly homosexual recruiters there at Harvard, wouldn't you think? I think that's the first stipulation, is they want green berets and negligees doing the recruiting there at Harvard. All right, let's move on, because we have a lot more serious news. Although that was fairly serious, we have much more important stuff going on. Let's go to Rutgers. Rutgers University, which I believe, is it Ivy League, my dear? Do we know if Rutgers is Ivy League?
Should I do this in the East Coast elitist accent for Rutgers? Well, I'm just not sure.
Anyway, Rutgers University, according to NBC in New York, Rutgers is set to launch a pilot program this fall that would allow students living in campus dorm rooms to pick roommates of the opposite sex. Yeah, the move intends to welcome more gay students to the campus. Now, this didn't make sense to me when I read it, and I'm still having a little problem. They're allowed to pick roommates of the opposite sex, and it's meant to promote homosexuals. That seems to be oxymoronic. Wouldn't the homos pick a roommate of the same sex? Wouldn't you think? I'm not sure how this helps the homosexuals, if they can be helped at all. But onward from the NBC story, gay campus groups have pressed the university for gender-neutral housing options for many, many years, to no avail. This pilot program will involve more than 100 undergraduate students, including gay, lesbian, and transgendered students. Many self-described LGBT individuals, including Rutgers senior Aaron Lee, eagerly await the opportunity to participate. Aaron says, quote, I'm really glad they did it, although I wish it wouldn't have taken so long. We live in a world where in order to be considered a human being, you have to be male or female. And not everyone fits into that kind of binary. It's important to have spaces where people don't necessarily have to worry, unquote. A footnote in the article, the program will also be open to heterosexual students, if there are any left at Rutgers at this point. I guess it's the heterosexual students who would choose the roommate of the opposite sex, if there even is an opposite sex. Who's to say? At Rutgers. Anyway, so that's what's happening in higher education. As we look back on the week that was and look forward to the implications upon the week to come. Now, let's get into politics. We've got an interesting story from the politics file. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, according to the Wall Street Journal, is criticizing Oscar winner Natalie Portman. Are we familiar with Natalie Portman, dear?
Yeah, I happen to.
You happen to know her?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, I'm not familiar, but apparently Mike Huckabee... are we familiar with Mike Huckabee?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember. Huckabee. Now, don't get on Huckabee about his recent unfortunate weight gain.
Okay.
He's been doing all right. Now, Huckabee said that Portman's out-of-wedlock pregnancy is troubling. He says, quote, it's unfortunate that we glorify and glamorize the idea of having children without being married. All right, Mike, I can't argue with that. Mm-hmm. And although I've never heard of Natalie Portman until now, the only time I become aware of her is because she has a trophy pregnancy. And, of course, she's not married, so just a typical Hollywood slut influencing the young women and men of America. Let's see, what else does Huckabee say? Oh, Huckabee really puts the lie to this whole idea of glorifying single motherhood. He says there, he says, quote, there aren't really a lot of single moms out there who are making millions of dollars every year for being in a movie. Most single moms are very poor, uneducated, they can't get a job, and if it weren't for government assistance, their kids would be starving to death, and they wouldn't have any health care. Okay, Mike, I can stand with you on that. I'm against all that. So I'm with Mike Huckabee, at least on this topic. I'm not sure if I agree with Mike on much else, but I agree with him on that. By the way, according to current statistics, 41% of all live births in America are out of wedlock. Oh, but that's not a big deal, right? That doesn't really portend anything for the future as far as the survival of Western civilization. The fact that we've trained our young women to be sluts and we've trained our young men to use those young women and then we've taught them to have a party when they find themselves pregnant. That's if they don't kill the child, which it's perfectly legal and acceptable to do, and in certain segments of the population, I dare say it's even celebrated. See, I wanted her real bad, and I was about to give in. But that's when she started talking about true love, started talking about sin. I said, honey, I live with him for the rest of my life. She said, no hugging, no kissing, will you make me a wife? My honey, my baby, don't put my love on no shelf. She said, don't give me no lines and keep your hands to yourself. All right, boys, put those guitars away. America's finest example from the mid-1980s of white trash on beer, the Georgia Satellites. I'm not saying I don't like them. All right, but put those guitars away, boys. We got some serious news to get down to here. All right, now let's go to Chicago. Why do we want to go to Chicago? It's 14 degrees and the roads are frozen. I don't want to go to Chicago, but let's go to Chicago. A story from St. Louis, I believe it's the St. Louis Dispatch newspaper. An appeals court in Chicago has upheld the rights of suburban Chicago students to wear T-shirts with the words, "Be happy, not gay." Okay. So what does this mean? Apparently, a teenager sued in 2006 after school officials blacked out the words "not gay" on her T-shirt. So she wore this T-shirt to Neuqua Valley High School, and the school officials, in true totalitarian fashion, actually blacked out the words on her shirt. And, well, then she sued. And apparently she's won. An appeals court has granted her the right to wear a shirt that says, "Be happy, not gay." The court says, a school that, quotes, permits advocacy of the rights of homosexual students cannot be allowed to stifle criticism of homosexuality. To which we heard a hiss arise in the homosexual community. But folks, this is where the court has it all wrong. If you have a school that permits the advocacy of the rights of homosexual students, by definition, you have to stifle criticism of homosexuality. By definition. Because the two cannot dwell in peace and harmony and love. Because normal people know what homosexuality is. It's a deviancy, it's a sin, it's a weakness, it's a corruption. It's an imperfection. It's not to be it's a crime, for crying out loud. It's not to be tolerated, certainly not to be taught in our high schools or our universities as something that's good and normal. And so now that our schools permit advocacy of the rights of homosexuals, by definition, they will stifle and stamp out all criticism of homosexuality, despite this meager court ruling there in Chicago. Those of you who are normal, which I'm assuming most of the audience is normal, and not a pack of deviants listening to the broadcast. Although we might have a homosexual or two who tune in once in a while just to see what the enemy's up to. I would assume that normal people have taken a look at the situation in the high schools and in the universities, and have wisely decided to remove your children from there. Or just don't let them get their meat hooks into your kids, for crying out loud. All right, do I want to get into domestic tranquility? I really don't even want to do this. Let's start with, okay, should I do Joshua first? So I'm reading through the Bible with my 9-year-old. We started in Genesis. We're in Joshua. And yes, I will confess that there's a bunch of stuff in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that we just had to skip over. I mean, some of the genealogies were really good for getting her to sleep. But there were a lot of the laws and the stuff. I think maybe we're going to wait to go over that when she's a little more sentient of theology in general. But we are in the book of Joshua. And we were reading through the story of one of the early cities. What was it after Jericho? It was Ai, the city of Ai, when God sent the children of Israel into the land. And he told Joshua, when you take the city, kill everyone in the city. And after I read through the story, and typically I'm pretty good at catching those things in the Bible that are going to strike a 9-year-old as odd, but I totally missed this. At the end of a paragraph, she stopped me and she said, Daddy, did God tell them to kill all the kids and the babies too? And, you know, I have debated PhDs and had acrimonious conversations with college professors and politicians. But I can honestly say I've never been caught as flat-footed by a question as I was at that moment in the bedroom of my 9-year-old daughter at 9 o'clock at night when she asked me if that was the case. And I answered her. I said, Nicole, keep in mind that God has all the answers. He has all the authority. And he never does evil. And there are times in human history when God chooses to take people from this life into the next through various means. We talked a little bit about the flood of Noah. And I told her, God, knowing all the facts and having all the authority, took the decision at the time of the flood that it was better to destroy everyone and save out only those who loved God. Rather than to try to build in the cesspool that had evolved. And I explained to her what had been happening in the land of Israel during the 400 years that the children were enslaved in Egypt, that the land was corrupted by pagans, that the bloodlines were even corrupted, quite possibly through demonic activity at the time, and that God was going to send Israel in to be a separate people in the earth, to be God's people. And God knew that Israel could not build and live amongst the heathens that had corrupted the land. And that God chose to take those people and move them from this life into the next life. And we are all designed to live our life in two stages. There is this temporal earthly life, and there is the life to come, the afterlife. And God has the authority to move any one of us from one to the other. And God has the wisdom and the righteousness to always do what is right. And I told her, Nicole, God did tell Joshua to go in and kill every living thing. Every man, woman, child, every goat, every bull, every ram, everything. Because God knew that his people would be corrupted by those people around them, and it would mean war for generations. It would mean strife and struggle for generations. And I said, Nicole, if you watch the news today, you'll see that Israel, to this day, struggles with those people because they did not follow God's command to cleanse the land. Well, so there was my answer. And I don't know if she understood it all. I'm not sure if I'm right about it all. I do know what I've read in the Bible, and I do know God. I know God is righteous. And I know that God is right. And let's just leave it at that. I suppose if I've said something that is theologically incorrect or offensive, that you could send me an email and try to point me in the right direction, because that was an interesting episode here at the McBurney compound. I'll tell you what. Okay. Now, do we want to go to the domestic tranquility file? Speaking about war, struggle, and strife for generations, let's go to Burlington, Colorado. This is from 9 News, right here, from the home base, Denver, Colorado. This is Burlington, Colorado, which is a small town just inside the border on I-70 from Kansas. From Burlington, Colorado, Charles Long, 50 years old, and his wife Marilyn, 51, were found dead in their Burlington home last Tuesday evening. The couple's 12-year-old son has been charged with 2 counts of murder and also faces 2 counts of attempted first-degree murder and at least 2 counts of aggravated assault. The Longs were shot to death. 2 children, brothers and sisters of the 12-year-old murderer, a 5-year-old and 9-year-old boy, were found injured at the home. The 5-year-old girl has knife injuries to her neck and back, and she was also shot. The 9-year-old boy has knife injuries to the groin, and he was also shot. Family and friends, according to 9 News, are at a loss to describe what may have happened inside the home. Charles and Marilyn, according to neighbors, appeared to be loving Christian parents, and the children were homeschooled. They had 7 kids. Burlington, Colorado has a population of about 3,500. And what can you say about this? This is the state of domestic tranquility in the heartland of America. Now let's go to Los Angeles. Deputies from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, according to CNN, responded at about 11 a.m. last Tuesday to a reported child abduction in Palmdale, California. They were told that a 17-year-old suspect had kidnapped his 5-year-old baby son from a person who was taking care of the baby and drove away. Police learned the teen had called the baby's mother and threatened to harm the child. So at about 3:30 in the afternoon, deputies saw the suspect driving and began following him. While in pursuit, they observed some kind of stabbing motion inside the vehicle. The deputies pursued the vehicle, attempting to get it to stop. After 2 or 3 minutes, the vehicle crashed into a building. The teen got out of the car and ran. When police got to the car and got the baby, they raced him to a hospital, but unfortunately the baby was pronounced dead at the hospital. The escaping teen was shot and killed by police. Relatives told KABC-TV that the 17-year-old father, Christopher Glass, who lived with his mother, was a good father to the baby, and they don't know why the incident occurred. Cousin Bobby Hudson described him as a, quote, great person, unquote. He also said, quote, I hate to see this happen, unquote. We all hate to see this happen. And everybody says, why? 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 Well, it's because of sin. Sin unchecked in a person's life by the Spirit of God will eventually lead to death. Whether it's at the hands of another, whether you become a murderer, it leads to bloodshed and death. And the sin in the lives of, well, both of these stories, I mean, we don't know what happened out in Burlington. We don't know what happened here in Los Angeles. But I can guarantee that there was unchecked sin in the lives of the people involved, particularly the killers. And the Spirit of God was not with them. That's why, in a nutshell. Now let's go to the justice file. This is depressing doing this every week, I tell you what. The state of the world is enough to make one want to just hunker in the bunker. But we will not. We will cast the news and our thoughts out to the world and do our best to try to provide something in the way of explanation for what in the hell is going on. Speaking of that, Stockton, California. A jury convicted Anthony Waiters in November of torture, kidnapping, child abuse, and false imprisonment. He was ordered to serve 3 life sentences concurrently and will be eligible for parole in about 19 years for holding one Kyle Ramirez captive and shackled to furniture for over a year. According to the child who was held captive, waiters cut him, lit his pants on fire, and beat him unconscious on several occasions between 2007 and 2008. At one point, he says, the captive says that waiters cut his arm and poured bleach on the wound. The emaciated teen escaped by jumping on a backyard trampoline, hopping a retaining wall, and running to a nearby health club back in December of 2008, wearing only boxer shorts and a shackle on his ankle that he had broken free. And this Anthony Waiters is going to be given, well, they say three life sentences, but they're going to be served concurrently. For those of you who may not be familiar with the jail lingo, that means that he's serving them all at the same time. So it's meaningless. And he'll be eligible for parole in 19 years. That's the state of justice, injustice, in America. And it's that type of injustice that's prevalent in our society that encourages weak-minded sinners to follow through on their unbridled hatred and lust of the flesh. And that's why domestic tranquility is what it is because of the state of justice, and vice versa. It's the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. I want to go back to the Justice File. To Plackerville, California, possibly Placerville. Plackerville? A Northern California couple charged with kidnapping J.C. Dugard and holding her captive for 18 years have given full confessions to authorities. So one would read that sentence and wonder, what does this mean? Does this mean we will see justice? Well, hold on just 1 minute. The revelation, according to the Associated Press, the revelation came as prosecutors and defense lawyers opened negotiations on possible plea bargains that could avert a trial and testimony by the victim who has sought privacy since being freed about a year and a half ago. So we've all heard the story of J.C. Dugard, and I find it astonishing that the authorities have waited, well, it's been 18 months, and now they've got a confession when they found the girl in the guy's house. I mean, doesn't that count as a confession when you find her in his house? A slave? Can't you just videotape the thing and 3 days later execute this bastard? Apparently not. I mean, we could have got a trial done in 3 days. We found the girl in his house. But no, what they're doing is they are setting up. This disgusts me in that, number one, they're going to negotiate possible plea bargains so that neither one of these two kidnappers, the husband and wife, will be put to death, which is what needs to happen immediately, if not sooner. They need to be executed for this hideous, heinous crime. But what does the press do, the Associated Press? They remind us, and this is straight from the lawyers, you can bet. They remind us that this would avert a trial and testimony by the victim who sought privacy. So we're really doing this on behalf of little JC because we don't want her to have to go through the trauma of a trial. And ladies and gentlemen, in a case that's this clear-cut, there's no need for JC Dugard to testify. There's no need for her name to ever come up again. But instead, we're going to stick to the process. Going to work a plea deal. Disgusting. Both defense lawyers, according to AP, both defense lawyers say the defendants are amenable to a settlement that would spare Dugard and her daughters from having to take the witness stand. So, folks, when the law can be used as a weapon against the innocent, which is what the lawyers basically threatened here, they said, well, you don't want to have little JC have to go through all that, would you? And her daughters, it would just be terrible. Why don't we cut a deal? That's a threat. They threatened the victim in the case. So when the law can be used as a weapon against the innocent, it's time to make some changes. And I would say that there it's time for some changes in our criminal justice system. well, let's we have some more from the justice file. From Washington, D.C., the Army has filed 22 new charges against private first class and openly homosexual Army member Bradley E. Manning, including causing intelligence information to be published on the Internet. And he's also been charged with aiding and abetting the enemy, a crime that can bring the death penalty. Yeah. So the Army has charged Manning with a crime that can bring the death penalty. This is from the Washington Post. The Washington Post goes on to tell us, although aiding the enemy is a capital offense under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Army prosecutors have notified the Manning defense team that they will not recommend the death penalty for the largest breach of national security in the history of our nation. I mean, they're going to have to disentomb Benedict Arnold and apologize to him, for crying out loud. All right. I'm getting a lot of angst built up over justice. I need to move on. Let's go to the war file, something that doesn't make my blood boil quite as much. This is from Breitbart's website. China's defense budget will rise 12.7% in 2011 to approximately $92 billion. A spokesman for the People's Liberation Army, he says, this will not pose a threat to any country, unquote. That's PLA spokesman Li Xiaozing. Li Xiaozing says, nothing to worry about here, folks. Go on about your business. By the way, the $92 billion number for China's military this coming year, that number represents a return to double-digit increases. That trend had been broken last year when the defense budget rose only about 8%. And as Li Xiaozing said, this will not pose a threat to any country. Don't worry, America. We still build your trinket. You'd have our trinket. You'd have them at McDonald's. Yes, yes. Don't worry about defense spending. No, no. We're peaceful people. Okay. More from the justice file. I thought I'd gotten out of the justice file. Not yet. Now, this is what you would expect. An MS-13 gang member, according to the New York Daily News, murdered a Queens man that he mistook for a rival Blood because the man happened to be wearing a red shirt. Julio Chavez, MS-13, is charged with emptying his revolver into Maurice Parker back in May of 2007 in Flushing, New York. Chavez then hopped into an SUV, flashed gang signs, and yelled in Spanish. According to another MS-13 gang member, Chavez yelled, "Yay, homie, that's how you're supposed to do it. You see the blood coming out of his head? The beast has eaten." The beast has eaten. So an assistant U.S. attorney asked the one MS-13 gang member to please translate the meaning of Chavez's rant. And the MS-13 gang member said he was acknowledging that he had just given a soul to the devil. Wow. Oh, that's MS-13. But you would expect that from MS-13, right? You would expect the beast to be fed by MS-13. What's shocking us is that the beast is being fed in Burlington, Colorado. And Los Angeles. Well, I guess Los Angeles you kind of expect it to, unfortunately. That's unfortunate for the folks out in Los Angeles. All right. One more from the justice file. Just to add insult to injury. I'm actually not sure how I feel about this story. I want to put this out there. One Vincent Vinny Gorgeous Basciano, or is it Basciano? He's one of these Italian guys. He's a maid. You know what I'm saying? He's a maid member of the Bonanno crime family. Vinny Gorgeous was charged with murder and racketeering crimes he allegedly committed on behalf of the Bonanno crime family back in 2004. So Basciano appeared in a Brooklyn federal court for jury selection without a tie. Yeah. Now, the judge, Nicholas Garufis, noticed that he didn't have a tie, so the judge lent him his own tie. Apparently, the judge had allowed Basciano's family to supply him with a suit, socks, and shoes for the trial, but a jail employee read the order too literally and refused to permit a tie for Vinnie Gorgeous, who obviously could not be guilty. Anyone named Vinnie Gorgeous from New York City, there's no way he could be guilty of racketeering, let alone murder. Anyway, the judge noticed that he didn't have a tie. And apparently it's a mistake on behalf of a relatively dim jail employee. Imagine that. And didn't give him a tie. So the judge lent Vinnie Gorgeous a tie and then suggested that he hold on to the tie until the end of the trial. At which point, hopefully, the judge will hang him with that tie. But I wouldn't hold my breath on that. Anyway, Vinnie Gorgeous. The judge loans him a tie. I just don't know. I mean, I suppose it's just a simple act of humanity to loan some poor slob a tie so he looks decent in court. But I just don't know if I can stand the fact that the judge loaned him the tie. I could see a defense lawyer loaning a murderer a tie. But a judge? All right. A judge is really just a lawyer in a robe. Yeah. And, I mean, you never know what's under that robe. All right, let's go to the ecology file. This is a new file at the Weekly Worldview, but we had a lot of ecological news break this week. So let's start in San Francisco. No. Yeah, we're going to go to San Francisco for news of the ecology. Eco news. San Francisco's low-flow toilets have resulted in more sludge backing up inside their sewer pipes. Well, can I take it from that you're not a fan of the low-flow toilets? I have never been a fan myself. Anyway, this backup of sewage and sludge has created a rotten egg stench near Candlestick Park, now called AT&T Park, and elsewhere. Especially during the dry summer months, San Francisco apparently is quite fragrant in their worship of Gaia with their low-flow toilets. The city has already spent $100 million over the past 5 years to upgrade its sewer system and sewage plants, in part to combat the odor problem that's been led to by the low-flow toilet worshippers. Now, officials are stocking up on $14 million 3-year supply of highly concentrated sodium hypochlorite, better known to you and I as bleach. They're using the bleach to act as an odor eater and to disinfect the city's treated water before it's dumped into San Francisco Bay. It will also be used to sanitize drinking water. So the worshippers of Gaia and their low-flow toilets out there in San Francisco have got to be having a conniption fit at the thought of millions of gallons worth of bleach being dumped into their sacred bay. So this is $115 million in a state that is flat broke just to combat the stench from the low-flow toilets. But the hippies are not going to lay down for this. A Don't Bleach Our Bay alert, did you get that? It's the Don't Bleach Our Bay alert, has gone out from an eco-blogger named Adam Lowry, probably one of the same pale, skinny potheads who was all over the politicians for the low-flow toilets in the first place. Anyway, so this pasty-faced pothead blogger, he argues the city would be much better off using a disinfectant like hydrogen peroxide, or, better yet, a solution that would naturally break down the bacteria. Well, that's all well and good, Mr. Lowry, but we have a serious problem that needs to be solved quickly, and unfortunately, we're going to have to take the side of better living through modern chemistry. We're going to use bleach because it'll actually clean out all the poop that you hippies have backed up all over our entire city. Thank you very much. Go back to your mother's basement and shut up. All right. Let's see here. As for whether, what is the story is from the San Francisco Chronicle. As for whether the supposedly environmentally friendly low-flow toilets are worth the trouble, well, according to officials, they have helped trim San Francisco's annual water consumption by about 20 million gallons a year, which is roughly a drop in the bucket. Thank you very much, all you hippies in San Francisco. All right, more from the ecology from Washington. This is from the Detroit News. Consumer Reports has offered a harsh initial review of the Chevy Volt. They say, quote, when you are looking at purely dollars and cents, the Chevy Volt doesn't really make a lot of sense. The Volt isn't particularly efficient as an electric vehicle, and it's not particularly good as a gas vehicle either in terms of fuel economy. This is from Consumer Reports, a fairly well-trusted and well-researched bunch of fellows over there. The magazine said in its testing in Connecticut during the harsh winter, the Volt goes about 25 miles on electric power alone, at which point you have to crank up the lawnmower engine that's hooked up in there, and that'll go about 40 miles an hour for a few more miles. Then you're pretty much stuck in the snow. And then there's a write-up in Human Events, folks. If you haven't had a chance to see this, I will excerpt it, but you definitely want to read the entire article. Last summer, after the rollout of the Chevy Volt, this is an author at Human Events. I don't know who he is. I apologize. But he says, I decided to sit down and figure out how much each of these fantastically expensive little cars actually cost. The sticker price is $41,000. Some media reports knocked off federal and state subsidies to declare the car costs only $33,500. Neither of these numbers represented the true cost of the Volt because enormous taxpayer subsidies were involved in bringing it to market. Those costs don't appear just because someone else, or everyone else, pays them. Subsidies obscure the true cost of a product, but they don't erase the underlying economic reality. Wow! That's good writing. The author goes on, dividing those subsidies between the initial production run of 10,000 cars and adding them to the sticker price, I came up with the true cost of $81,000 per Volt. I allowed that if sales were good and Chevy were ahead of their planned production of 45,000 more Volts for 2012, it might become reasonable to divide the subsidies by the higher grand total of 55,000 cars and come up with a lower but still appallingly high cost. Well, the number of Volts sold in the month of February of this year was 281. Worldview. Every time I listen to that song, I think I'll figure out what he's saying. To this day, I can't figure out a word of it. I think he says I got my head spinning around, but that's about it. All right. Now we're running out of time. I've done it again, and I didn't even get to the chess. All right, we're going to get to the chess right now. So my 9-year-old daughter, obviously she's a genius, advanced beyond her peers in dramatic and amazing way. Anyway, she's a smart kid. I was teaching her how to play chess just a few nights ago, and I was a little rusty. I have avoided chess for decades for reasons that will become apparent and may already be apparent to many of you. I have avoided chess, but I remembered the rules, and I taught her how to play, and we got the board set up, and after a couple of scrimmages, I told her, this is it. This is for all the marbles. And then after I explained to her what all the marbles meant, then we got on with the chess game. Now, as I began playing, I realized that I was playing a 9-year-old girl who barely understood the rules of the game. But I started to win. And I've got to admit that as I closed in, and I took a bishop, and I took a rook, and then I took out her queen, shockingly enough, she took one of my bishops. I didn't even see it coming. She's 9 years old. She doesn't even know the rules yet. She snuck up on me and whacked out one of my bishops. So at that point, I got serious. I said, I'm taking this kid out. And I was being friendly the whole time, but I'm not going to lie to you. I wanted to put her in checkmate. And when I put her in checkmate, I'm telling you that I had a rush go through my body because I haven't won a chess game in 25 years. And I finally won. I'll tell you, my brother, My brother Scott was a savant when it came to chess. But by the age of 10 or 11, he could beat anyone I knew. Even the high school kids, he could beat them in chess. And so I was my brother's chess whipping boy. My brother would just beat me at chess in a half a dozen moves sometimes. Well, that's probably an exaggeration, but only a slight exaggeration. My brother could play some chess. In fact, one time my uncle Bernie came and visited us, and Bernie was probably in his early 30s at the time. And yeah, Bernie, McBurney. My grandmother was an interesting woman. She had six sons. She had Tom, Don, John, Bernie, Jim, and Joe. Tom, Don, John, Bernie, Jim, and Joe. Now, Bernie came to visit us, and me and Scott were probably early teens, 13, 12. Bernie's 30-something. He tells us the story of how he played Grandmaster Bobby Fischer. Him and like 100 other guys paid a bunch of money, and Bobby Fischer came along and beat them all in like 2.5 hours, 6-7 moves apiece. But Bernie fancied himself quite the chess master. And Bernie sat down with Scott. And if I remember correctly, I don't remember all the details, I'm sure, but I do remember that Scott won. And, it was shocking to everyone, probably no one more than Uncle Bernie, who had just been defeated by my brother Scott, who was probably 13 years old. God bless him. God rest Bernie's soul. Bernie died of just some awful cancer. Pancreatic cancer. Anyway, why am I getting into all this? Oh, because I started talking about chess. So anyway, that's why I never played chess, because I have deep-seated feelings of embarrassment and doubt in my mind about chess. But I'm back on that horse now. Yeah, it'll just be a couple of months, Nicole will be wiping the floor with me with chessboard. Anyway. Let's get to more news, if we want to. Do we want to get to more news? How much time could possibly be left? All right. Let's go to, from National Geographic, let's see. Global warming's a big problem. We all know that, right?
Right.
Well, they say that a nuclear war between developing nuclear powers such as India and Pakistan would have significant climate effects. They say that the global cooling caused by the high carbon dust cloud kicked up by the nukes, let's say that were hypothetically exchanged by the Muslims and the Hindus, that would lead to unprecedented climate change. Global warming temperatures would drop by 2 to 3 degrees for 2 or 3 years after a nuclear war. So for any of you out there who are concerned with global warming, don't worry, Iran almost has the bomb. So you should sleep better at night if you're worried about global warming, because there's going to be a nuclear war that's going to fix all that. More from the ecology. This is from Washington, D.C. A Taurus XL rocket carrying NASA's Glory satellite destined to study global warming lifted off early last Friday morning from Vandenberg Air Force Base and then fell into the sea. So it's the second failed global warming satellite launch. Back in 2009, another satellite failed to make orbit. That satellite would have studied global warming, and it crashed into the ocean near Antarctica, where it turns out it was pretty cold. Let's see. NASA has already started a board to investigate the mishaps and quite possibly to award patronage jobs to the cousins, nephews, aunts, and nieces whose employment depended on the successful deployment of the global warming satellite. So those jobs hopefully will be saved as they study the mishaps. Had the Glory satellite reached orbit, it would have been on a 3-year mission to analyze how airborne particles affect Earth's climate. See, it would have been up there when the Iranians launched their first nuclear rocket, and we could have seen if the data from the last article proved to be true. But instead, it's deep in the ocean. Glory would have also tracked solar radiation to determine the sun's effect on climate change. So these are the best minds in the world, and they're putting up a satellite to determine the sun's effect on climate change. Generally, I mean, I could help you out here. The sun makes it warmer. in general. Then at night, when the sun goes down, it gets cooler. And then at a certain point in the year, the planet tilts on its axis, and the sun... Maybe I'm in over my head. I mean, I don't have a PhD. I'll leave that all up to the scientists to determine the sun's impact on climate change. Okay. Now, from the science, really, file, from NASA, this is from Fox News, Dr. Richard B. Hoover, an astrobiologist with NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, has traveled to remote areas in Antarctica, Siberia, and Alaska, amongst others, for 10 years, collecting and studying meteorites. Research published last Friday in the March edition of the Journal of Cosmology on behalf of Mr. Hoover describes the latest findings in his study of an extremely rare class of meteorites called C11 carbonaceous chondrites. Only 9 such meteorites are known to exist on Earth. Hoover is convinced that his findings reveal fossil evidence of bacterial life within such meteorites. By extension, the findings suggest, according to this scientist, Dr. Richard Hoover, the findings suggest we are not alone in the universe because he found some bacteria fossils in a meteorite. Dr. Hoover fractured the meteorite stones under a sterile environment before examining them under a scanning electron microscope and a field emission electron scanning microscope, which allowed him to search the stone's surface for evidence of fossilized remains. He found the fossilized remains of microorganisms not so different from ordinary ones found underfoot here on Earth. And he says this is very exciting, that they are in many cases recognizable and can be associated very closely with the generic species here on Earth. But he says there are some that are just very strange and don't look like anything I've been able to identify. And so what do we have? Is this E.T.? Is this finally contact? I'm looking at the pictures here of these bacteria, and I don't know. I mean, what are the odds that the meteorite came from the Earth? What are the chances of that? Is there any chance that these meteorites came from the Earth? Let's say at the time of the global flood when the Earth's crust cracked open and exploded and blew ice and water and everything else out into space? Is it possible? No. I find it amazing that a scientist finds evidence of some bacteria that he can't quite identify, and he's already, the entire scientific community is giddy about the idea that there could be life, and they want to talk about it as life. It's life, it's life, it's life. But if you show them the human DNA of a 12-hour-old human embryo, they can't be sure that that's life. Certainly can't be sure that it's human life, and we're certainly not ready to say that's a person. But this bacteria, that's it. We're ready to celebrate in the streets because we found life. These are the greatest scientific minds in the world and what they're working on. All right. They should read, what's the book? My favorite book about the origins of Earth and the universe is Dr. Walter... Anyway, the name of the book is In the Beginning, and the author's name is escaping me at the moment. Walt. It's a great book. In the Beginning. Check it out. He has a fascinating and fairly convincing theory on where meteorites and comets and things like that come from. And they come from the Earth. All right. Now, more from the science. Really? File. Let's see. We have a biochemist named Christian De Duve. He's a professor emeritus at New York City's Rockefeller University and won the Nobel Prize in 1974 in physiology medicine. He says, quote, natural selection, that's evolution. Natural selection, he says, has resulted in traits such as group selfishness being coded in our genes. Now, these traits were useful to our ancestors under the conditions in which they lived, but have become noxious to us today. So this is a fellow who believes that we rose up out of the slime, and I forget if we became birds or fish or any of that, but eventually apes and then us. And so our ancestors, he's talking about our like Neanderthal cavemen, and apparently it was okay to be selfish back then. But he says this selfishness brought on by evolution is now coded into our genes. De Duve has written a book called Genetics of Original Sin. I said Genetics of Original Sin, in which he explains how he sees the intersection of his theories with the Bible. He says, quote, "I believe that the writers of Genesis had detected the inherent selfishness in human nature that I propose is in our genes, and they invented the myth of original sin to account for it." Now, the biochemist is quick to point out, he says, quote, "I am not acting as an exegete. I don't interpret scripture," unquote. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Deduve. Indeed, according to the article from WorldNet Daily, indeed, while the Bible prescribes redemption and regeneration of the human heart through Jesus Christ as the solution to mankind's inherent selfishness, Deduve proposes another answer. Can we guess what it might be, boys and girls? Population control. That's right. He says, it's always popular with the leftist scientists, population control. I wish they would start with themselves. I know, that's mean. I apologize for that. Deduve says, quote, "It is a simple matter of figures. If you want this planet to continue being habitable for everyone that lives here, you have to limit the number of inhabitants." To me, that sounds like killing people. That limiting the number of inhabitants could also be stated as we need to kill a bunch of people. And the funny thing is, folks, is nothing in science or evolutionary thought informs him that this is an immoral position. Nothing. There's nothing in science that informs anyone that killing people is wrong. There's nothing in science, and certainly nothing in evolutionary thought, that would inform someone that killing innocent, weak people is wrong. Well, that's why we're here, ladies and gentlemen. If Mr. Deduve and other scientists need guidance in this area, I'm happy to make myself available to them. Be happy to meet with them at Harvard, even. Or Rutgers. All right. More from the war file. In Islam is bad, Pakistan, according to the AP, militants gunned down the only Christian in Pakistan's government last Wednesday. Shabazz Bhatti had been threatened by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The 42-year-old Roman Catholic said he was, quote, "ready to die," unquote, for the country's often persecuted Christian and other non-Muslim minorities. The slaying in Islamabad followed the killing of Salam Taseer, a liberal politician who was gunned down in the capital by one of his guards. We covered that last month. And so the situation with the war in the Middle East continues. What do we have? We're almost out of time. I apologize. From the Daily Mail, a new video has emerged from Pakistan depicting children role-playing a Taliban suicide bombing. I just don't want to even read any more about that. These are little kids in Pakistan. They're an ally in our war on terror. Their kids play, instead of cowboys and Indians, they play suicide bomber, and they blow each other up. There's a new, from Nashville, from WMC TV in Nashville, Tennessee is considering making it a felony to follow some versions of Sharia. Yeah, at least 13 states have bills pending that would bar judges from considering Sharia in legal decisions. Well, that's just disturbing that we have to have an effort against Sharia. I mean, is that freaking anyone out? I'm kind of freaking out about it. Okay, into the politics file. We'll get rid of that one because we don't care. From Madison, Wisconsin, state officials said last Thursday that damage done by hippies and potheads and other communists to the marble inside and outside the state capitol would cost an estimated $7.5 million to repair. Yeah, why did they even let the hippies camp out there? Those people never clean up after themselves. Next thing you know, they'll be installing low-flow toilets, and the whole place will stink to high heaven. Terrible. Anyway, for all you folks in Wisconsin, when we, the Christians, take your state house in Wisconsin, not only will we not harm a single person, but we promise we won't break anything either. All right. And finally, from the Reuters Wire, a shocking story. Nicholas Galiastasos, owner of Nina's Bella Pizzeria in Upper Darby, try saying that three times fast. Owner of Nina Bella Pizzeria in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, is accused of putting bags of mice at nearby competitors' pizza houses last Monday afternoon. The owner of Verona Pizza watched Galeastatos go into his restroom carrying a bag and then emerged empty-handed. The police later found a bag of mice and footprints on a toilet seat, suggesting someone had been trying to reach the ceiling tiles. The officers then found Galeastatos near another pizza joint, Uncle Nick's, where he was seen putting something in a trash can. When police looked in the trash can, they found a bag of mice. Oh, man. Anyway, the Upper Darby Police Superintendent Michael Chitwood, he said, quote, "I've never seen mice used as a criminal tool, but he has now." You know what's going to be great about the afterlife? I mean, once we get past the whole dying thing, I mean, I don't like that idea. But once we get into the afterlife, a lot of people think we're going to be floating on clouds and playing harps. I think that we're going to be living and doing business, and we'll be in heaven or on the earth, maybe go back and forth. I don't know how that all works out. But we're going to be able to do business knowing that we can trust the other people that we're doing business with. Now, will there be deadlines missed? Will there be business failures in the afterlife? I think there will. But at least nobody's going to be out to rip you off. And boy, is it going to be easier to do business in that environment. Thank you. Even so, come Lord Jesus. That's it, folks. That's the Weekly Worldview for this week. Should the Lord tarry, I'll be back with you next week. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, at TheologyOnline.com, my friends at Personhood USA and American Right to Life, and of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.